record yet because I'm... Okay, first of all, on top of the material, you have a sheet that says important biblical dates. And what I did was go back from the time of Abraham and just pretty much give you the biggies. What's highlighted in the middle of the page is pretty much some of the important extracurricular material that I'm going to focus on during a large part of what we're doing today. So you might want to just keep that handy so as we talk about certain things, if you're interested in a date that may have occurred, that you'll have that available. All right, so I welcome you to Introduction to the Bible, Part 2, concerning the New Testament. And we're going to start, first of all, talking about the period between the Testaments. This is the time between the writing of the last Old Testament book and the writing of the first New Testament book. It lasted about 400 years. The end of the 400s BC has the prophets Nehemiah and Ezra helping to establish what will become the new Israel. We're going to see that Israel is being revamped. There's changes that are going to be made, and from some of what happened in the old experience, it's going to be changed and it's going to be called New Israel. This would be God's new people back from the Babylonian exile. So when the southern kingdom was taken over and conquered by Babylonia, the people that were the educated people, the people that had some prominence within the southern kingdom, were carted off to Babylonia first and more or less set up there. And then later, other waves of people were taken out of their own country, taken away from what they knew, and moved into the Babylonian area. And from what we talked about in the Old Testament study, remember there was a theology where the thinking of the day was pretty much that if we're obedient to God and we follow God's law, we will be blessed. And if we're not obedient, we'll be cursed. So when these people end up in Babylonia, well, obviously, we did something wrong. God wouldn't take us away from the temple. God wouldn't take us away from the promised land if we hadn't done something wrong. So they're going through a whole analysis of that experience and what that meant. A weakness develops with these people now, basing their identity upon birth. Being Jewish now depends upon being born into the right family with the right genetics and having the right citizenship. This new attitude causes them to become more and more exclusive. More and more exclusive. They withdraw and really push the theme of separation to the farthest extremes. So even though they're away from their homeland, they're away from their temple, they're away from everything as they knew it, they're going to pull together and unite wherever they are, and they're going to reestablish their identity. They still want to be God's chosen people. So they're taking a look at what they can do to still hang in tight as a group, even though these bad circumstances have happened. A number of Bible books were written during this, what's called the intertestamental period, even though they may have been placed within the Old Testament section at a later date. So when we talked briefly about the canon last time and how the books came to be accepted into Holy Scriptures, this is what happened. Some of the writings happened at a certain time, and then when they sat down to determine the canon, well, that was more applicable to the Old Testament. So even though it was written during this intertestamental period, it ended up being placed into the Old Testament. One of these books is the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth, this book, was written as a rebuttal. As a rebuttal against the ideas of separation and exclusiveness. So within the community, we're going to see that there's a debate going on about should we be exclusive or should we not be exclusive. So the book of Ruth is one that's written and is against the idea of that community being totally exclusive or totally separate. As we know, Ruth is a Moabite, not of the Hebrew lineage, who chooses to stay with her mother-in-law, Naomi, who is Hebrew. The purpose of this book is to show the line of King David and Jesus both come through Ruth, a non-Hebrew. So if your greatest king and your Messiah come through the lineage of a Moabite woman, we certainly aren't being exclusive or separate. So this book is really working to point that up. It concludes that even Israel's greatest king came from a Moabite woman. Thus, the book of Ruth says that God works outside of Jewish lineage too. So many times in our faith, this isn't too far-fetched. We get a little bit exclusive. We're the innies and somebody else are the outies. And this is our heritage. This has been going on since the beginning of time, pretty much. But this book is working to say, God works, period. God works outside of the Jewish lineage too, and that the Jewish genetics are not needed to be included within God's plan. The book of Ruth was written by Jews to speak against Jewish exclusivism. During this period between the Testaments, the question of citizenship, usually claiming genealogy all the way back to Abraham, becomes even more important than keeping the law. Now, up to this point, keeping the law had been supreme. But now, genealogy, the genetics, the lineage took on a greater importance. So the separation theme did dominate for a period of time, even though there were forces working against that idea. That idea still pretty much held tight for a while. A shift occurs so that now the temple rituals designed to improve their relationship with their God aren't used for that purpose at all, but are used to maintain that identity. So rather than enhancing their relationship with their Lord, it was more of a thing to prove that they were part of the chosen people. The function of striving to be righteous in the eyes of God shifts to simply doing it right, which then meant that you were truly part of God's chosen people. This shift caused a loss of joy regarding being in relationship with God. So rather than the relationship being the thing to have joy about, it switched over to a preoccupation with carrying out the law to show how Jewish their identity was. So prophecy pretty much stops because the focus of the people was only on doing it right to be part of the chosen people, causing a loss of all spiritual inspiration. They weren't operating in a spiritual manner. They were operating in a legalistic manner to prove who they were and to prove that they still had status with God. So what was missing? The discerning spirit seeking relationship with God was missing. That's why I think Tim has mentioned from the pulpit so many times, and if you're an officer of the church and going forward with the master plan of this church, praying always for the discerning spirit to work within so that we don't take on our own separatist ideas and so forth, that we always seek for God to open up that discerning spirit within us. Okay, some of the achievements that happened during this period between the testaments. Number one was worship. Worship changed in this new Israel during this era. The book of Psalms is brought together during this time as a hymn book for the temple. It showed that worship wasn't idealistic, but corporate. Now we're talking, they've returned from the exile. They're back in their homeland, and they're trying to reestablish themselves. So in the reestablishing of who they are and what they're doing, their worship is changing. So that's what this is referring to. The worship wasn't individualistic, but it needed to be corporate. They needed to really push the idea of God's chosen corporately. And the Psalms did this, since the singing of the Psalms was always done within community. New Israel recognized itself to be a worshiping community. Number two, new festivals existed. Three major pilgrimages took place to the temple in Jerusalem to reinforce their corporate identity. So certain festivals, when a time when they were required to come together as a large corporate community to reinforce, again, who they were. And the third one, the unfulfilled drama. This was the way that the people kept living out their struggle to be God's chosen people and also to try to remain true to their calling in the midst of all the various cultural tendencies toward a narrow exclusivism. Within the surrounding territory and what they had already been through and experienced by various conquering groups, all of those exterior forces that existed, they were constantly bombarded with various cultural tendencies toward exclusivism. We see that in the books of Jonah and Esther, they respond to some of this unfulfilled drama and the tensions of the people being lived out during this time. It was kind of a floundering time. It was a time when they weren't real secure with who they were and with what was going on in their history or their everyday lives. Jonah was written in response to the developing attitude of a narrow exclusivism. God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh and preach God's message to them to turn away from their wicked ways. So Jonah's a prophet. Prophets are carrying God's message to a certain group. God gives the orders, and the person carries out those orders. He was to go and tell them that if they would repent, God will save them rather than destroy them. So the warning's being given, and the people then make their choice. However, Jonah says, I don't want to go. I don't agree with you, God. This is not acceptable for me to go to Nineveh and give God's message to them, because Jonah wants God to wipe them out because they are outside the people of Israel, so that they should be totally wiped out. Why are we going to care about them? They're not part of your chosen. I don't get it. He believes that God should only save Israel and no outsiders. We're the chosen. We're all that's important. We later see in Jonah's story that Jonah cares more about this little broom tree than the people of Nineveh. And that is one of the most hysterical things that you will ever read. Jonah marches off in a huff, and God causes this little broom tree to grow up because he's in the middle of like a desert area, hot, no shade, nothing. So God in his mercy has this little tree grow up and to shade Jonah. And then the next day, or whatever time it is, the tree dies. And Jonah's so upset about this tree dying and not being there anymore, and just instantaneously he loved this little tree. And God says, you know what? I created those people in Nineveh. Those are part of my children. You care more about that little tree than you do those people. So Jonah ends up, obviously, nobody's going to get away from what God wants him to do. So Jonah does it, but he kind of does it in a huff. The book of Jonah speaks against the very narrow perspective of who God loves and who God saves. It shows that God loves all people who turn to him and choose to follow his ways. Esther is another interesting book. It's the only book in the whole Bible that never mentions God. Doesn't mention worship, doesn't mention sacrifice, doesn't mention the things that the chosen people are all about. It deals with a continuing problem that Israel had with a group of people called the Amalekites, who were the first people to attack the Hebrews as they entered into the promised land of Canaan. So this rift between the Israelites and the Amalekites had been going on for years and years. They've long held a grudge against the people because they were the enemy at one point in time. Esther is a Hebrew woman, and she becomes queen to King Xerxes of Persia and is able to stop him from destroying the Hebrew people. So Persia was one of the outside conquering nations that overtook part of the northern kingdom. No, that may not be right. That's Assyria. But was one of the contenders for that land and marching in with an army and had caused great problems and so forth. So here's an example of God having a person in the right place at the right time. So she's his queen. She's Hebrew. He wants to destroy the Hebrews. The power of a woman convinces him not. This book applauds Esther because she remains loyal to the attitude of separation. So here you see something different happening from the idea of people outside. But the way I view this is the Persians were outside and God didn't just march in this time and decide to destroy them. He used the queen to make the difference so that his will would be done. The Hebrews have more of a mission, so they cannot ever totally be destroyed for God's mission to go forward. Both books show that there is a strong debate. So here, the book of Esther pretty much deals with separation and the fact that the Jews should not be overrun at that point, that they are not going to be conquered by Persia, they're going to remain separate. And the book of Esther kind of points that up as a good thing. The book of Jonah says even people outside of the chosen, God has a mission for them. So we have a little bit of each taking place. Both books show that there is a strong debate during these intertestamental years about who God's people really are. And that's not going to go away. During this period of history, with the advance of the Greeks and the practice of Hellenizing, Hellenizing is a term used by the Greeks to say that everybody that we conquer is, we're going to make them similar to us. We're going to enlighten them. We're going to have them learn our language, have them learn our culture, because we're the best. We're the conquerors. So that's what the Hellenizing practice was all about. The cultural identity problem of Israel is elevated even more. So if you're trying to, you're the group that says the Israelites should be separate and should have your own worship, have your own language, have your own culture, and then the Greeks come in and take over and say, no, you shouldn't. You should be more like us. Then that's going to create a little bit of a problem for them. So we have a cultural identity problem of Israel being elevated. It's a bit hard for us to understand these Greek cultural influences being so strong, how that influence can kind of overtake another culture. But if we think back to Japan, whose culture about 50 to 75 years ago was about the same as it had been for the last 1,000 years earlier, compared to today, where there's now a huge influence of the Western world, evidenced in Coke, McDonald's, Calvin Klein, all of that existing, we can get a little bit better slant on how one culture can kind of persuade another culture to change. The same kind of cultural influence was upon Israel due to the Greek Hellenist influence at that time. The prophet Nehemiah was afraid that they would lose their language, that the Israelites would lose their language, and eventually they do, when Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, Aramaic was a language influence from the Persian influence upon them. It becomes the common language of the masses of Hebrew people. So in the time of Jesus, Aramaic is very much evident in Israel, in that area. So that influence, Hebrew is taught to the Jewish children to a certain degree, but it's not their speaking language. It's not their common language that was being used. This was seen as another step in the loss of their original identity. So in an attempt to keep their identity, they begin to have it kind of splintered away. The New Testament shows three languages existed in Palestine. The Aramaic that we've just mentioned was the common street language. Hebrew was a religious language used in the temple and in the synagogues. And Greek was used for the international discourse of trade and commerce. These 400 years were a time of great uncertainty when they returned from exile in Babylon to a world around them that's shifting, and they aren't sure who they are with so much cultural change, which they are often at a loss to resist. So even though they work very hard to keep their own identity, they're being bombarded by a cultural impact over and over again. There are a few terms that are going to come up in the New Testament or this period in between that you should have a little bit more information about. The first is called the Apocrypha. Apocrypha means hidden in Greek. These are additional books not used for theological purposes, but they do provide a valuable source of information regarding historical events and culture during the intertestamental period. The canon of scriptural books met a certain set of standards to be included. During the time after the exile, all Hebrew scriptures were gathered together. They worked to determine the ones that met a certain standard and were considered authoritative. Wisdom and apocryphal writings were not included. It took about 400 years after the exile to finally determine the set and set the Old Testament canon. So when we think about the canon, we need to think about in the very last thing, if you look clear at the back of the packet, there's information about the Old Testament canon and the New Testament canon and how it came to be. So you can read that over on your own. But it didn't just happen. Different groups of people, lots and lots of people, the tradition of the church, hundreds of years went into making that decision. So the criteria had to be met for books to be included. Now, different denominations have dealt with it a little differently. The Roman Catholic Church has accepted these apocryphal books in their canon. The Protestant churches have not. So there's a difference between some historical and cultural knowledge being presented, which is nice to know, versus theological information, which is required. So that's kind of what happened with the apocryphal books. The Protestant church would say, these are extra, these are additional, this is some nice to know information, but it's not theologically based. It's just some historical information, some cultural information that's helpful. In AD 90, a combination of Jewish rabbis from the lands of the Jewish dispersion, plus early Christian church leaders, agreed upon the scriptures to be included in the Old Testament canon. This canon was closed to any further additions. So we said this intertestamental period was about 400 years, may have lapsed almost to 500 years before AD 90, when they said, okay, we've regrouped all of the Hebrew scrolls, we've gotten everything gathered together, we've had lots and lots and lots of scholars going over the information, and this is it. This is, it's set now. At a later date, Jerome translates the Old Testament writings into Latin and puts this is pretty interesting. Jerome has the duty of taking those Old Testament writings and translating into Latin, because at this time the Roman Empire is in control. And he puts a footnote on these apocryphal books that he translated, saying they were not included in the Old Testament canon. Okay. But later copyists, using Jerome's translations to translate into other languages, dropped the footnote. Oh, that's a that little note, that's not scripture. Boop. Forget that. We're going to drop that out of there concerning the apocryphal books. Remember, translating into Latin. This error caused them to be included in the canon in these other translations for about 1,000 years. And therefore, this may be a reason why they're in the Roman Catholic canon and not elsewhere, because Jerome's little note got, boop. Funny how things happen. During the Protestant Reformation, Jerome's footnote was discovered once more, and these apocryphal books were then removed from the Old Testament canon. Later in the 17th century, the Roman Catholic Church held a council and decided to include the apocryphal books in their canon. So I'm not sure about Greek Orthodox. I think they may be included in theirs as well. But they're not secret. They're, you know, if you read through them, they're pretty entertaining. One of them talks about Jesus as a child not being aware of what his powers are yet, and zapping kids, or, you know, somebody that irritates him, he says something to them and they fly across the room or something. So obviously they decided that that should not be in the official scriptures, whether it's true or not. So you have a lot of fable type things of what people think might have happened, because as you know, when you read the Gospels, they don't give us a lot of detail of Jesus as a child. So then we have all the great thinkers sitting around saying, I wonder what he would have acted like as a child. And before you know it, that gets written down somewhere. And so you have to be careful that that doesn't get included in something that's the inspired word. Okay, another term to know is diaspora. This means the dispersion of Jews started during the Babylonian exile. Jews living outside of Palestine couldn't participate in the temple requirements, so they studied the Torah more thoroughly. Here's back to the law. So they began to take what they had. They didn't have the temple. They couldn't sacrifice. They couldn't do that part of their faith. So they took what they did have. They had their scrolls. They had their law with them. So they studied the Torah more thoroughly and became involved in synagogue life. The exile cut Jews off from the temple. They were surrounded by pagan religious practices. At this time, Israel's faith could have become extinct. They were separated from what the most important thing was, being their temple. But they concentrated on what they were able to retain of their faith. They were able to retain the Torah, the law, and they were able to retain the fact of uniting as God's chosen people. Since the sacrificial system couldn't be done outside of the temple, they concentrated on the law, personal piety, and prayer, which were all centered at a synagogue gathering. And this was like within a home, not a big building at all, sort of like our life groups, a smaller setting called synagogues at that time. They developed the feeling that Judaism could be practiced anywhere as long as the Torah was present. Their relationship with God was being based on their ability to know and keep the law. Be obedient. We find ourselves sitting over here in Babylon. We don't know what we did wrong, but we sure must have done something wrong. So we are going to get back and open that law and learn that law and get that law down. Then it'll be good. Then it'll be better. Synagogue worship preserved Judaism and provided a way for the Christian gospel to spread. Pretty interesting that as the Jews were dispersed, and we're going to see later through various conquerings, that they're dispersed into Egypt, they're dispersed north of Palestine, they're dispersed, and we know from history that they're dispersed all over the place. So we'll get to that perfect piece of the puzzle in a little bit. Septuagint is another term to know. This is pretty cool too. There's a Jewish legend that says about 70 scholars, Septuagint, 70, gathered on an island near Alexandria, Egypt, and produced this Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. This took place in about 250 BC. All 70 prepared their own independent translation, and when completed, they miraculously were identical. Probably at least the Torah was translated by these scholars. So when we say that, was it all of the Old Testament according to the canon that we have now? Probably not, because the Torah was the meat of their scriptures. The writings and the prophets and so forth existed too, but remember, we're trying to be obedient. If we're trying to be obedient and get back in God's favor, we need to concentrate on the Torah. And even for all the Jews that are separated now and away from the temple and away from Israel and in Egypt and elsewhere, the temple isn't there. So we need to grab onto the law. This translation was used by Greek-speaking Jews living in Alexandria first, and it was the Bible of the Jews living outside of Palestine, because this group no longer spoke Hebrew. So when we go back to our identity, we've been so enmeshed in the Greek culture now that because we don't have the temple situation going on, maybe we're too far away to make those three festival journeys to the temple, and we don't know our Hebrew anymore. But at least they saw and recognized that they had to have that law translated in the language that they did know, and they caused that to happen. Further, it was the Bible of the early Christian church. So when the apostles go on their missionary journeys and so forth, the Bible that would have been used at that point in time would have been this Greek Septuagint, the first translated version. Okay, back to the history. historical evolution that the Hebrew people encountered. Over the last 600 years, the dominance of world power shifted over and over and over again, starting with the Persians being in control in the Persian Empire, switching over to the Greeks being in control in the Greek Empire, switching over to the Romans being in control in the Roman Empire. So they really were bombarded with so many different people, so many different rules and regs to follow, so many different cultures. In 538 BC, the Hebrews return from the exile in Babylon. So they get to come back, they get to regroup. So they had a period of time, 538, then going to 450. 450 to 330 BC, Persia takes over and allows the Jews. This was the good thing about the Persian occupation. They weren't so much concerned with the religion that was going on among the Jews. So they allowed the Jews to have their own religious practices. The people were ruled by their own high priests who were responsible to the Jewish government. So as long as they complied with, you know, trade and, you know, keeping the rules that the Persians set down, didn't get rebellious in nature, then the Persians kind of allowed them to coexist being their own people. So that wasn't too bad. Then enter Alexander the Great. 336 to 166 BC, Greek Empire started with Alexander the Great. He conquers, and is known to say to his generals of his army one day, "There's nowhere else to conquer. What am I going to do now? We've conquered all the known world. So we have to get everybody to speak our language. We have to get everybody to know our culture. We have all these great philosophers. You know, these people need to be educated along these lines. We're the greatest." So Alexander the Great brings the Greek culture, education, and language to bear as a major impact upon the entire world during this time. This was called the Hellenistic period, which was designed to unite the world by making the Greek culture and language universal. At age 20, Alexander starts his rule, defeating first Persia, then Syria and Egypt, and going on all the way to the Indus River in India. So he had a huge empire. The Greek Empire began with Alexander the Great. He brings military conquest plus a whole new philosophy of life and human potential. You might say that he was the first possibility thinker in history. And by that, we see that Alexander was tremendously influenced in his way of thinking by the philosophy of Aristotle. So we've got Socrates and Aristotle and all the great philosophers are during this period of time. Alexander was tremendously influenced by Aristotle. During this period, there was a classic debate between the philosophers themselves, between Plato and Aristotle. Plato taught that so Plato was Aristotle's teacher, and then Aristotle becomes a private tutor to Alexander. These philosophers debated about various ideas, such as, how do we know that things are true? What really exists? What is reality? I remember the first philosophy course that I took, the only philosophy course that I took in college. Is that a table, or do we simply perceive the molecules floating together there to be a table? Hey, that's higher than my brain goes. But the great philosophers debating what really is, what is truth. Plato said that reality has two different worlds to it. The first is the world of matter. The world of matter would be the concrete, that which is perceived by the senses. And the second world, the world of spirit, spirit being the abstract or the world of ideas. Plato said that the physical, what he also called the particular, and the spiritual or the idea, both exist, even though the spiritual can't be perceived by the senses. So all that exists is not simply concrete and touchable. There's a lot of other stuff that exists on a spiritual realm, says Plato. Aristotle, his student, doesn't buy it 100%. He disagreed with his teacher. He didn't believe in spiritual reality and said the world of ideas did not exist at all. He said the only real thing was the particular, the concrete, which could be perceived by the senses. These two philosophical thoughts have collided in the Christian world concerning how we know God, or whether there even is a God. Aristotle said that there was no God because God wasn't physical, God wasn't concrete, so a God could not exist. Aristotle taught that the person alone made things happen. The great individualist. Alexander accepted Aristotle's philosophy and conquered the world as a result. Boy, there's an impact of one teacher. Wow. Aristotle tutored Alexander and led to Alexander's Hellenistic thinking to not depend on the gods. Remember how many gods the Greeks had? So this was a huge influence by Aristotle to have Alexander grow up thinking that there was no need to depend on the gods at all. Depend on yourself. So Alexander believed in the mighty possibility of the individual as long as the individual was Alexander. His own energy could conquer the world. He truly believed it. Once he conquered, he then brought them under his way of thinking. Alexander made great changes in the world in just the few years that he ruled, from 36 to 23. So when you think about all that he conquered and all the wheels that he started rolling, huge impact. His passion and push were really necessary since he died at age 32. So he started at 20, he conquered the world, he set up new culture and language, he kind of universalized the world in many, many ways, and died very young. When he died, four of his generals split the Greek Empire. The two that were most important, Ptolemy was the general that took over the part in Egypt, and Seleucus took over the part in Syria and Mesopotamia. Both of these generals vie to control Palestine over the next 100 years. So it's a lot of teeter-tottering among those who took over. Things were pretty united with Alexander, but as often happens, when that type of a dynamic leader is no more, then things begin to splinter. In 250 BC, the Hebrew scriptures were translated into the Greek Septuagint, as we said. Ptolemy's followers were also considerate of the Jewish religious practices, but this changed when the Seleucid dynasty, took over in 200 BC. So things were pretty calm on that Ptolemy side when he was in control. Things went pretty smoothly, but we're going to get a new leader coming around the block that's going to make life unbearable. A segment of the Jewish aristocracy.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What was the life before that?
Up to. Oh, I skipped that, didn't I? Yeah, Alexander was possessed. Alexander was possessed with the spread of Greek ideas, culture, and language. Anything else? Okay. A segment of the Jewish aristocracy did adopt many Greek ways at this time, but the majority of the Jews were outraged, totally outraged, at being forced into learning the Greek culture and language. This did not match their separatist idea. This did not match their exclusiveness. of being God's chosen. A Seleucid king, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, ruled from 175 to 166 BC. He wanted to do away with the Jewish religion altogether. We are the conquerors. We will divide and conquer. We will not allow people to have their own identity. They have to switch over to our way. We're the winners. He committed atrocities toward the Jewish religion by attempting to destroy all copies of the Hebrew scriptures, the scrolls. So when we think about what happened with the Hebrew scrolls, to me that it's just mind-boggling that, you know, all of these different empires coming and conquering and wanting to set up their rule, so to speak, you have holy scriptures that you cannot have destroyed, taken, burned up, done away with. So therefore, a dispersion of the holy scrolls as well. And we find out through the Dead Sea Scrolls that are discovered and so forth that, you know, they were dispersed into all kinds of places. And it, to me, it's just so miraculous how they were discovered and brought back again. It just blows your mind away. Whew. But they were attempting at this point to do away with their scriptures. And he also said that circumcision couldn't be done because it was a violation of the body. And if you think back to the Olympic Games, the Greeks worshiped the bodies, the body, violation of the body. So circumcision, that was a sign that you were in covenant with God in the Jewish culture. That was very, very, very important, and all the process that was gone through at that time as an identity mark, a mark of identity of who a Jewish male was circumcision. And this Greek guy walks in and says, nope, not going to do that anymore. Antiochus never really understood their thinking, and to show them who was in control, he entered Jerusalem with his army and plundered their temple, took it over, and put a statue of Zeus in there. He required offerings to be made to the Greek god Zeus, and even had a pig slaughtered in the Holy of Holies, which is the most sacred area of the Hebrew temple. And going back to Leviticus, pork, pig, no, no. So it was just like, he was taking everything that was sacred to them and rubbing their nose in it. 166 to 63 BC, the Hebrews responded. The Hebrews, for the most part, after they get into the promised land, are a pretty compliant people. They have not really been a truly warring kind of people. They never basically have thought that way. Well, you walk into their temple and you do these things, we're going to respond a little differently. They respond to these atrocities, and this is where in the Apocrypha, the books of 1 and 2 Maccabees, gives a historical information about this situation and what was taking place. So has historical value. These atrocities recorded in 1 and 2 Maccabees within the Apocrypha. The Maccabee books have two recurring phrases which are the best commentary for this period of time. One is, the king made a name for himself. The king made a name for himself. And they saw their wealth and they attacked. So this period under this Seleucid dynasty was a time of marauding tribes with two kinds of influences, those out to get all the wealth that they could amass, those wanting to build their own empire and make their own kingdom. So the Greek era was a time of great insecurity and instability. You didn't know from one day to the next who was going to be in control, what they were going to demand. So within the Greek Empire after Alexander, you have all of the generals kind of vying to be king, be top dog, have it their way, and the Hebrews are just sort of living through it. The Maccabees were a Jewish priestly family. Priestly family meaning from the tribe of Leviticus way back when, Levi, and they were all, according to their heritage, serving within the priesthood and doing priestly functions. In 167 BC, a priest named Matthias Maccabeus was performing his duties in the temple when Greek soldiers came to enforce the edicts that had been put down by Antiochus. In a fit of rage, now he's a priest within the temple, okay, but there's such a thing as righteous indignation. So in a fit of rage, Matthias turned on the Greek emissary and killed him. A spontaneous rebellion started as a result of Matthias's actions. He fled to the mountains. Matthias fled to the mountains nearby and was joined by his sons and others feeling the same way as he. His son Judas led a type of guerrilla warfare group, attacking the forces of Antiochus in kind of a guerrilla warfare manner. The Jews believed that when they were devoted to the law and stood up for their religious traditions, what they knew was right according to the law, that they would prevail against Antiochus's forces, and so they did. In 166 BC, the Maccabeans were successful. They retook the temple, they rededicated it, they repurified it, so to speak. They got everything out of there that had been an atrocity that Antiochus had brought in. And on this occasion, the oil lamps, remained lit miraculously for 8 days, which became the Feast of Hanukkah. So it was almost like the feeling was that God's with us. You know, there wasn't enough oil in those lamps to stay burning for a full 8 days with nobody going back and doing their priestly duty to keep that going. Nevertheless, they stayed lit for those 8 days, creating so that brought about the Feast of Hanukkah, the Festival of the Lights. The Maccabean victory gave them independence for a time. So the Jews have not been independent very many times. This is a time of independence for them. Kind of an interesting side point. Many people began to believe that this Matthias Maccabeus was the promised Messiah because he was able to overthrow the Greek oppressors and he reestablished the nation of Israel. Palms were even laid down when he defeated Antiochus and rode into Jerusalem in victory. However, the Roman takeover of Jerusalem took away the hopes. Therefore, they knew what the prophecy about the coming Messiah was and how the coming Messiah would conquer the oppressors and set up a kingdom for the Hebrews, and it just seemed like this was the Messiah. Well, the Romans conquer them later on down the pike, so nope, not yet. The success of the Maccabeans was attributed to the fact that they kept the law. They themselves attributed their success to the fact that they were devoted to the law. They kept the law. By the time of Jesus, the law had become extremely important, almost to the point of worshiping the law. Extremely important. But this was soon to change. How short the memory is. The Maccabees set up trade agreements with Rome. Rome supported them because Rome was trying to take domination away from Greece. So we've got Rome gaining power, Greece losing power. So the Maccabees have destroyed a portion of the Greek empire and enter Rome to be a friend. The Maccabees set up a government similar to a republic, which eventually became known as the Hasmonean dynasty. These Hasmoneans came to follow the way of the world and set themselves up as an aristocratic ruling class. So, how long do we keep the law? How long do we keep our identity? have our own government now. We have our own dynasty now. So we're going to be a little aristocratic. We're going to be in charge. Which evolved into a Hellenistic regime acting similar. Get this. Who had they just defeated? The Seleucids. So what happens 10 minutes later? We're going to be just like those guys. So they begin acting very similar to the Seleucids, previously disliked by the Jews. Two separate factions arose. And here we go again. Once we have power, what happens? You got it? I want it. So we're going to immediately run into two different factions arose, with one side being more Orthodox Jews versus Jewish Hellenizers. So Orthodox, we're going to keep all of our Hebrew culture, language, the law. We're going to be really firm in that. Hellenizers, those Greeks had an awful lot of good ideas. I think we could incorporate some of that and still be okay. Soon, civil war broke out. Also, Rome was gaining power and challenging Greece for dominance now. The Roman general Pompey saw this situation in Palestine as a chance to show his own power and get back at the Greeks too. Good deal. I can get powerful. I can take care of some Greeks. Sounds like a deal. In 63 BC, Rome joined the forces with the Hellenized side of the Hasmonean group, the Hellenized Jews. The civil war ended, and so did the Jewish independence. So Rome came in kind of as a protector, and oh yeah, we'll work along with you, and then, oh, we got rid of your enemies, and now we'll take care of you. So, civil war ended up in totally losing their independence. Pompey used the Hellenized Hasmoneans to rule Palestine for the Roman Empire. It just so happens that Herod is of the Hasmonean dynasty. So now when we think about Herod and all the Herods, the Herod line, this is where the link comes. The Romans really didn't want to have to worry about Palestine too much, because why? They're just starting their empire. They've got a lot of other lands to conquer and things to do. So as long as you all stay pretty calm over here, we'll let you kind of govern yourselves. You'll pay us some money, because we get into a tax issue here. What else is new? Pretty soon. But at this point, these Hasmoneans that they kind of joined say, okay, you can do your own rule, but you know, we're the empire. So as long as we understand that, everything will be good. Roman control was opposite of the Greek control. It was a time of tremendous stability. Once Rome had really established their empire, there really wasn't any vying, conquering group lurking. So a lot of what happened with the Roman Empire was from within, not from outside. So as far as the known world is concerned, it's really a time of tremendous stability, probably the most stable that peoples had experienced up to this point in their history. The Pax Romana, P-A-X, second word, R-O-M-A-N-A, which meant Roman peace, unified the world. The Roman influence ultimately signaled the end, though, of the Jewish world. In the next 100 years, Rome tolerated a lot from the Jewish people. Many I hate to use the word terrorist, but sort of, people that were so into their own independence and their own way and their own separation and so forth. These were the fighters. These were still some of the guerrilla warfare type of people. Many zealots and false prophets stirred the people up from time to time to time and did give Rome a little bit of a headache off and on. In 66 AD, another Jewish rebellion broke out. There have been many minor ones that were squelched pretty quickly, but AD 66, a Jewish rebellion broke out, but by 70 AD, just 4 years later, Jerusalem was burned to the ground. So in an attempt to become independent again, didn't work. The temple was totally destroyed again. Most of the Jews fled this area entirely, which began a major, the big dispersing of Jews into many other countries. After 70 AD, there's no history of the nation of Israel until we get to 1948. So no more attempts to gain independence, pretty much totally dispersed, vast majorities living outside of their homeland as they had seen it. This happening led to new religious and political structures were necessary. If we don't have a temple, here we go again, just like when we were in Babylon. No temple, no temple worship, no temple sacrifices, no temple festivals. Something else has to exist for us to keep our identity. So, the synagogue came into being. Synagogues had developed back during the exile when the temple could no longer be the central for sacrifice and worship for the folks. A new temple couldn't be constructed because the law says that the temple has to sit upon Mount Zion. Mount Zion does not exist in Babylonia, so no temple. So the synagogue becomes the local institution of worship that they bring back with them from the time of the exile. It's instituted during the exile when they're away from their homeland, but it took such a hold upon the peoples that they kept that within their religious practices. The focus of the synagogue was, guess what? The law. The law. Always. People came to understand the law more thoroughly. Since many synagogues came to exist in Israel, there was a need for interpreters of the law to ensure that the people were being taught correctly. Remember, we're living in a time where people don't read, people don't write. We only have a certain group that's designated, taught, trained to do that. So the scribes, we hear Jesus talking all the time about the Pharisees and the scribes. Well, the scribes were the law experts. I often thought that the scribes were just the guys that copied everything. I didn't know that they had any great realm of knowledge, really, but they did. So they actually were the law experts of the time, and they were highly honored. They determined the exact interpretation of the law for every situation. Every situation of life, no matter how small. During the time of the Maccabees, the law became the basis for community life and belief because the law told them how to live according to God's design. Thus, there was no hope for a righteous life without the law. The scribes were responsible for teaching and interpreting the law for even the smallest of situations. Both the scribes and Pharisees tried to develop a system of smaller laws which were designed to surround and protect the greater law, being the Ten Commandments. It's talked about the Ten Commandments being sort of fenced in. So the belief was that you would still be obedient if you didn't infringe upon those Ten Commandments. But from those Ten Commandments, like a spoke, there were hundreds of minute laws that if you broke one of those, well, you better hear about it right now so you don't enter into those Ten Commandment laws. So that's kind of what the scribes were doing. The greater law could not be broken. If they developed enough minutiae laws, a person might break one of them without breaking the greater law, and thus avoid causing separation from God, leading to spiritual death. The scribes and the Pharisees saw their mission was to create a minor law buffer so that the people could get back in and break, could never get back in and break the heart of the law. They convinced themselves that these multitude of laws were a good thing designed to protect the people. So when we talk about legalism, part of their reason for doing what they did was good. They felt that they had messed up by not keeping the law pure. And the belief was that even one sinner could cause judgment to fall upon all the nation, all the people. And they have the exile to prove it. So, if we come back from that, and those in the know create, you may not do, you may not do, you may not do. And I hear this week after week, and, you know, I don't know what's dispersed for a person to have on a daily basis, but you're going to hear it all the time when you're in synagogue. Then by golly, I'm going to do it right. Nothing can happen to not do it right now. Jesus faces this problem and states that these laws had evolved into being used for a personal advantage. Isn't that surprising? The people in the know are using these as a personal advantage of the scribes and Pharisees themselves. They were worshiping the law and leading the people to do the same. So in protecting the law, they actually were perverting and killing the spirit of the law. Get this. The Jewish Mishnah, which are these minute laws, was a commentary on how to keep the law. It contained 24 chapters on the commandment of keeping the Sabbath holy. Okay, one of the 10, keep the Sabbath holy, so we'll just whip out 24 chapters on how you are to keep the Sabbath holy. The Talmud defines the law even more specifically. So, the law was really defined down to the nth degree, ad nauseum, I'm sure. Both were written between 250 and 150 BC before Christ, both of these two different interpretations of the Ten Commandments in the law. Jesus often expresses exasperation with the scribes and Pharisees due to their manipulation of the law and their leading the people far astray of the true relationship with God. And I think that's really a critical thing for all believing peoples to constantly remind ourselves of. Are we worshiping the building? Are we worshiping the leadership? Are we worshiping anything that exists here, or are we still worshiping God? It's something that just has to constantly be a reminder to us. Okay, several political groups grew up, and I'm going to do this, and then we're going to take a break. Last page. One of those groups, we've already mentioned, the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the synagogue party. The synagogue party. They were separatists and conservatives. They held fast to the law and the traditions. When we say the traditions, that kind of means the Mishnah and these, you know, other laws that were created. They worked to reinterpret the laws so the Jews could obey and live rightly before God. They were supported by most of the people of the day. Most of the Jews were in agreement with the Pharisees and what they were doing. They had considerable influence over popular opinion. And they did believe in resurrection of the dead. Another smaller group called the Sadducees, they were the temple party. So remember now, the synagogues out and about, many more, only one temple. So the Sadducees are the temple party. They were a little more liberal thinking. They saw the law in a looser framework than the Pharisees. They were mostly the aristocratic class, fewer in numbers. They traded cooperatively with Rome and were called the people of wise compromise. Love it. Wise compromise. Their wealth causes their vested interest in the status quo under Roman leadership. They had political power. They had control of the high priesthood. They only accepted the Torah. They did not accept this minutia law of the traditions held by the Pharisees. They don't believe in resurrection of the dead because nothing in the Torah says anything about resurrection of the dead. Okay, so they're more the liberal bent, but liberal in the fact of being friendly with the Romans, being in trade with the Romans, getting perks from the Romans. That's kind of where the Sadducees were. Then we have a group called the Essenes. They're a small group that are staying separate. They lived mainly in Qumran, which was the area where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. They gathered as a group during the Maccabean conflict. And they kind of stayed separate from that time. They favored strict legal observance. They believed that they were the true remnant of correct Judaism. They rejected Judaism at large. They saw fault with what the Pharisees were doing. They saw fault with what the Sadducees were doing. They felt that the temple priesthood was corrupt. They rejected much of the temple ritual and sacrificial system. We remember the story of Jesus and what happened with the sacrificial system and him overturning the tables and strewing the money about and so forth. So these folks were pretty much saying that what was in the law as part of the temple sacrificial system, that people were lining their pockets from Roman coins having to be switched into this and the pricing of whatever the animals or the things were that needed to be sacrificed. They were lining their pockets. So that was outrageous to them. They had an apocryphal mindset. Apocalyptic mindset. So what that means was they felt that the Messiah was going to come soon, that the Messiah was going to conquer Rome, that they were going to be ready to be part of the forces to do that. So in the process of their Messiah coming, they were going to purify themselves. They were going to be ready and waiting for the Messiah to come. They'd be ready to be in force with the Messiah to conquer Rome. And then zealots. Zealots, we said before, they were sort of like super patriots who would fight to the death for their beliefs to reestablish the independent nation of Israel. And some folks have felt that Judas Iscariot may have been in this zealot category, that some of his actions may have been done because he was trying to kind of force Jesus to be the Messiah he was expecting. So he very well could have fallen into this group of folks. All right, we're going to take about a 5-10 minute break. Coffee, restroom, whatever.